And so I have added a few comments in there. So if you want to have a look, they are in italic. They're easy to spot. That were maybe things we didn't come up during on Friday. And I've posted the second part of the notes. And yeah, I will post the homework and soon today, hopefully. It for now. There any questions from last time? I restart with my drawing of this thing. Okay, let me remind you the notation. We have a spacetime M with possibly two boundaries, sigma, and I will consider that the topology is conserved, so it's a globally hyperbolic spacetime. I will denote G, the metric on the spacetime, the 4D metric, and the 3D metric H, like is the one induced on the boundary, and N is the normal. In case I look at sigmas with boundaries, what I really mean is that I'm looking at the portion here. And so there will be a boundary and a time-like boundary connecting the two. So maybe I draw it. This will add an extra boundary. I will still call it sigma. Except that it will have a boundary. So then we looked at these mixed forms. Well, we looked at spacetime forms and field space forms. And then today I want to start with mentioning these mixed forms. So alpha, for example, is in KL M cross F. It means that. What does it mean? It means that inside here there are dx a1, dx ak terms like these, and d phi l times. I will not put in, well, let's say 1. Let's see. And everything I will consider is local. And in fact, there could even be derivatives acting on these guys. So there might be even something like this would be part of this space, okay? So I just count how many bold Ds there are and not whether they're acted on with derivatives. So usually these derivatives are then contracted with. But what I count is just the Ds in here and the big Ds in there. So I will give a couple of examples and we will see immediately why these are interesting. Before getting there, one last thing is that this K index, so whereas let's start with L. The L I will be interested in zero forms, which are functionals, one forms like the symplectic potential, two forms like the symplectic form, and basically that's it. I will not really go farther than that. K, on the other hand, will start from the top dimension. So I will start with a Lagrangian is a density. I will write it down in a moment. So it is actually a top form on M. So instead of giving a name to the dimension of m that I will keep forgetting if it is d, d plus 1, whatever, I just call it top. And then there will be top minus 1, top minus 2, and essentially that's it. So as you can see, I go up in one form and down in the other. So the top just means that whichever manifold I put here, it's a top form on that manifold. I cannot go higher anyway. So if it's m, it will be d plus 1 dimensional. If I put sigma in there, the top form is just d dimensional. So it's, I think it's easier to keep track instead of remembering whether d, d plus 1. OK, so let me give you a theorem, which is useful, and then an application, which gets us immediately started in the direction that we want to go. This theorem says that if I have top one forms on M plus F, these decompose as a direct sum of top one forms, which are source and top one forms, which are boundary. I will say now what these are. So the fact that there is a direct sum, it means that a top one form can be uniquely decomposed into one piece like this and a one piece like that. Let's start from the easy one. What is a boundary form? It's just something in the image of D. So this is D of omega top minus 1, one forms. And source, it means that it is proportional to d phi x. And by this, I mean it does not. So first of all, it's a one form. So that's all there is. It does not contain any pieces like this.
Sorry, I'm not sure. Top comma one.
There. Top is a top form on M and a one form on F. So it means that it's a top form on M, a density, and it contains a d phi. But as I said, L forms can also contain derivatives in general of these d phis. And we will see examples in a second. What I call a source form is then when that does not happen. I just give this name, though, to one form. Okay? That's all I need. So I don't try to generalize it further. OK. So I think an example will clarify what I mean here, because it's so well known that we have actually already used it. But this gives us, the theorem is essentially about integrating by parts. I take a delta of something, and I integrate by parts until I remove all my derivatives from the delta phi, and whatever else I put it on the other side. It's just, it's as simple as that. So example, consider alpha 1. Which is phi d phi, for example. So this will help me set some notation. So what I mean by this, I mean fx dA d phi of x dxa. So this is just what I mean by this. And the bold d and the partial derivative, we say that they commute. They just go across. And also, since I'm saying that these commute, that's my convention, I don't care where I put it. I can put it on the right, on the left. Then let's consider alpha 2, where instead I'm looking at this one. At this one, what I mean by this is dA phi, d phi dx. Okay. Is it clear how I'm using the formulas? So now, which one is a source form? Alpha 1 or alpha 2? Supposing that I am on a one-dimensional spacetime, so that these are top forms. Yeah, so on, so suppose M is one-dimensional, then alpha 2 is a top form, is a source form. Whereas this is not. Now, alpha 1 plus alpha 2, on the other hand, is just d of phi d phi, and this is boundary. So it's quite intuitive. It looks super heavy, but in fact, when you start manipulating the object, it's quite intuitive how it works. Okay, so let's now, if there are no questions, I will start with the Lagrangian, and so we can keep going.
What is this theorem telling you about the topology of the manifold? Because this is basically telling you that the top one cohomology class on that space is just given by this source form. So it's just basically one-dimensional or dimensional.
No, you can think, I think the easiest way to think of this is like an integration by part theorem, then in terms, so if these, if I want to take alpha 1, OK, let's take alpha 1 and decompose it into its source and boundary parts.
No, I just mean that it has some topological implications, not just.
So the point is, top forms are OK. Top forms are, so usually when you look at a cohomology, you mean you have, you change the dimension of your forms. You go from one to the lowest one. So top forms are always closed. So in a sense, looking just at top form simplifies the matters. So that's what is interesting here is not so much what happens applying D, but rather, well, it's not even that. It's just
that the top comma one cohomology is literally given by the source forms, which are not like, it's in principle telling you that that cohomology class is smaller than you would expect in principle. Because you have integration by parts. But integration by parts, if I think about it, it's something more local, but that the composition is not local, it's global.
Okay, maybe I haven't thought about it in this term, so we can maybe discuss. But anyway, when I apply delta, the fat D, I don't need to get zero in any of those terms, just to be. The fact that this is proportional to d phi doesn't mean that it's the application of bold d to that form gives zero. But we will see it immediately, so I think it will be clear. So maybe that's a good exercise, actually, to say alpha 1, if it's a top one, it's a top one form. And so how does it decompose? Well, it's essentially what I do is to write it as these minus that. So this is what the theorem tells me, that there is a unique way to do this. So once I find a way, it's also the only one. So this tells me that it is minus alpha 2 plus d phi. So this is the unique decomposition. So this is source. This is boundary. Okay, so now we are ready to look at the covariant phase space. So how do I write an action? An action, I can write it as the integral of some Lagrangian scalar. So this is a tensor scalar. Or I can just think of these as the integral of a top form. So this is a top zero form on. What does it mean? It means that it is a function of my fields and also a top form on spacetime. Why a top form? Because I've reabsorbed essentially these two pieces, which is a volume form on M. So, but now what I'm trying to convince you is that working with these guys is actually very convenient for manipulating things without keeping track too much of the tensorial indices that can come up. So what happens if I take, now this is a top zero form, if I take the variation of my action, what will happen is that I'm looking at this guy, so the baldy of the Lagrangian density, the variation of the Lagrangian density in field space. And this is a
what is that
top one form.
What do you mean by tensor scalar? What does that mean?
Oh, it's just a scalar. I just mean it's just a scalar. In tensor, in the sense that what is natural to do to this guy is to take its covariant derivatives. And I just mean a scalar. Like, it's just a scalar. It's a tensor with zero indices. That's what. So as a scalar, it transforms. It just says how things transform under diffeomorphism. So if you apply a diffeomorphism to a scalar, you just take its derivative. Whereas if it is a scalar density, you would have to do extra. So this is just to distinguish. So there are three natural things to look at: the tensor scalar, the scalar density, that would be these two taken together without the form part, and the top form, which is like a scalar density with its form attached to it. So what I will look at are tensors and forms. I will try not to use the density. So these are slicker to manipulate. The tensors are what you use to do computations in practice. But to prove theorems, the forms are way, way easier. Okay, so this is a top one form now, right? Because I just took a d, increases this index here, this bold d. So now I apply my theorem, and I say that I have one source form and one boundary form. So what do you think this is? These are the Euler Lagrange equation, right? So how am I writing them? I'm just, what I'm doing is, so let me be a little pedantic for what I'm doing is to say I'm taking is minus dA of dA, d, dA phi, x, and multiplying this by d phi x. So this thing that you do all the time, that you integrate by parts until you isolate delta phi, is actually just summarized by that theorem. It tells you that there is a unique way to do it, and it gives you. Notice that we will not care about this right now. We will do it later at the end of a couple of lectures. What the theorem tells me is that this form is unique, not what is inside the D. I could always add extra corner terms, no? Because d squared is always zero. So if I add something to this theta, it's not unique. But this tells me that there is one such theta. The e part is unique. That is unique, for sure. So the equations of motion are unique. What is not unique in principle is this guy. So let me give it a name.
So that is square root absorbed in a top form, right?
Ah, sorry, I forgot to put this.
But we don't need that square root of g, right? Because it's inside the top form. Right?
Yeah, I just say that my top form is these together with that. And in fact, I call that epsilon. Is the so I don't want to do it now. So this guy, on the other hand, is the covariant symplectic potential. Symplectic potential, but since it's still a form, I also call it current because it's not integrated. And I call it a current instead of a form because it's a top minus one form, which are called currents. And we will see in a second. So this is a top minus one form. And the way it reads is I can write it, I call it a current because if I write it as a tensor, in fact, I can, it has, it's convenient to write it as one index up as a vector or dually as a top minus one form, but the vector is the more intuitive version. And this is dl over d dA phi. So let's integrate these guys so that will be a little bit clearer what I'm doing.
Potential current theta.
Yeah, just the theta is the current. So what happens if I integrate? So this tells me that I can integrate theta on, since it's a top minus one form, the natural place to integrate it is on sigma, which is a top minus one manifold. It's a codimension one manifold. So I call just theta on sigma the integral of the current on sigma. So this is all I have to write if I use forms. If I want to use the tensors, this is like the divergence theorem. I get the normal. Well, I get H. It's always a, well, it's top on with respect to sigma, is always top.
So, sigma could be anything, right? Choose anything. On the
yeah, it's any, it's.
But the sigma that you're choosing is just a time-like surface, right?
That sigma is a space-like. So, but it could also be time-like, you're right. It's any codimension one. Yeah, it's any codimension one surface. Or, as you said, if I call B, I forgot to mark it, the blue surface is B, I could also do the same. Yeah, because the only thing that matters is the dimension. So when I write, so there is, it's just a matter of a bit of gymnastics to repackage forms as tensors, but this is the basics. So when I integrate, that index is contracted with the normal, and I obtain just the determinant of the inducement. So that's why there is one index. OK.
Sorry, can I ask?
Yes.
It's a d top x, which should be d top minus 1.
Well, the trick of using the notation top is that you always have to write to read where it's defined.
Sure.
So here I'm integrated it on sigma, so it's just a top form on sigma.
Sure.
So that's the advantage. I don't have to remember my convention of calling of giving d plus 1 dimension to spacetime d dimension. I just look at where things are defined. So when I say here top minus 1, I was working on m. So easy. On m cross f cross.
Aldo?
Yeah.
Why did you write that theta is that? Like, you're defining theta by looking at d theta. So you have a freedom in choosing.
Yeah, I'm saying that's one choice. I'm saying
okay.
It's true. I could add. So what can I add in the in? I will do this in a couple of lectures. I just want to use the simplest possible choice for now. But then, of course, it's ambiguous in reality, and I have to worry about it. But I want to worry at the end and not at the beginning. Otherwise, it becomes super messy to keep track of all the ambiguities. Now, I want to define what I mean when to go on shell. Because some equalities will be equal only once we satisfy the fields satisfy the equation of motion. So I want to say that F bar is the set of fields over M such that E of phi is 0. So this is the shell, right? It's just, I just want to give a name to the space of fields that satisfy the equations of motion. And I call, and I just put a bar. Also, this is a notation that I will not use a lot, but this space of fields is embedded in my big space of fields, like the on shell and off shell. So if I have a one form, like sorry, a form which is some KL form there, what I can do is to pull it back. And I will say in a second what this means. So this means not only evaluating it on shell field configuration, it also means that the field variations I'm feeding it are on shell, so they satisfy the linearized equations of motion. So I'm doing two things at once. So this means, so let's say that alpha here, for simplicity, is the one I was considering before. For example, this one. This means that in here, not only phi satisfies the equations of motion, but also d phi satisfies the linearized one. Why? Because it means that it has to stay tangent, essentially, to my on-shell surface. So it means that it satisfies the linearized. So does that make sense, this statement? So
what is the linearized equation?
Hmm?
What is the linearized equation?
Oh, the linearized equations of motion, it means that, for example, let's look at box phi plus m phi plus lambda phi cube. So So this is a possible equations of motion. So I'm not only looking at these, I'm also looking at fields. The variation must satisfy so this is my background. Like by background I mean phi the configuration I'm at, but also that. So this is what I mean by linearized equation motion. I develop the equation around a solution at first order. Of course, this case is simple. Gravity, for example, would be
require a lot. The vector to the tangent of that surface, right?
Well, it's not really so these are forms, they're not vectors, but supposing that the same is true for vectors. I want just to consider vectors which are tangent. So it, more than a projection, it's just that you restrict to tangent vectors. And tangent vectors must satisfy this step.
Why is that true then, that alpha would satisfy the both of these equations?
Because if you, this comes from the fact that if E, let me write it here. If E is equal to zero on shell, then also its D must be zero. So when I take D of these, I get that equation.
Because that's a linear map and we can just commute these.
This just goes in. The differentials always go through the pullbacks.
But then if that argument is the reason, then that would be true for if any field satisfies the first equation, it would satisfy the second one.
Oh, but phi and d phi are independent objects. So here I'm just demanding that this is so on the pullback. On the pullback manifold, D of that is always true, but not outside. So thinking of vectors, you can have in the ambient space, you have tangent vectors, but also some that are transversal, even though they are based at the submanifold, right? So here I'm just, it means that I'm just looking at the tangent.
So the process is just putting bar on top of phi, if I want to like push that alpha.
Push?
For instance, you wrote one alpha there, right? D phi.
So this is an alpha, yeah. What? Oh, here.
If I want to this process and this alpha, is it that simple that just putting bar on top of phi?
Essentially, if you know, if your solution is defined by certain parameters, then you just pulling back is always easy. If you know exactly what the solution looks like, you just plug it in and you're varying the free parameters that are left over.
Sense.
Because then you just vary inside the space of solutions, which is exactly what you want to do. Yeah. But usually one does not know the solutions explicitly, so the best one can say is that this satisfies the equations of motion, and this satisfies the linearized one. So all of these to say that in case I have an equality that holds only on shell, I will denote it with an abbreviated notation, which is super common in all the literature. On shell equality, sometimes called a weak equality, but what I mean is alpha is equal to zero on shell. This means on shell, if and only if, by definition, I'm doing. So for forms, for functions, this just says that I'm evaluating it at a on-shell configuration. For forms, I'm asking more. I'm not just evaluating the form at a non-shell configuration, I'm also asking something more about the variation. This will simplify a lot of equation. And now we see immediately where one place where this is important, which relates to what we did in the previous lecture. So
this symbol means both these things, right?
Yes, exactly. So at the same time. Good. So now I define, so I have a symplectic potential, and I want to define the symplectic form. So symplectic the covariant is important because they're not really symplectic objects, but they are generalizations. So it's important to add the covariant. Covariant symplectic form aren't for the same reason as before. What is this? Well, exactly what you expect. I take my potential and vary it. So this is, I'm following the same logic that we learned, except that I'm doing it in this more general context. And right now, I want to discuss briefly how it relates to what we did. But not super rigorously, a bit that we will do later on. So the first theorem that we want to prove is that this as a current is conserved on shell. Omega is conserved on shell. And this has important physical implication, actually. So it looks like a very simple theorem. The proof takes one line. So we start from the only equation we have, which is delta L equal to E if d theta. And what do? We take an extra d, because that's the only way to have omega appear over here. And of course, what we find is 0 equal dE plus d omega. And now, on shell, this vanishes by definition. So d omega. And you see that it's important to have this stronger definition for forms to be on shell, that also the one form part is on shell, because this is a one form. Otherwise, I could be on the equations of motion, but look at things that get me out of the equations of motion. And then it wouldn't be true anymore that this is.
Independent quantity than d, right? And then you mentioned that because of this, we can set d equal to 0 too, right? But I didn't get why.
So this is a one form. This is like that alpha. I'm saying the same thing as I was doing there. And I say that when I go on shell, e is 0 on shell. And so d of e is also 0 on shell.
Problem accepting that, because the d and de must be independent. And e equal to 0, but like.
But this is because I'm saying, this is because of this. I'm saying that, is this reasoning over here? It's true, being on a configuration on shell and looking at a variation, that variation in general takes me out of the shell. But the way I define being on shell with this pullback is a bit stronger. It tells me not only I need to be on shell, but also look at variations between solutions. So what I'm doing here when I go on shell is look at the space of solutions. And all variations take me, at best, from one solution to another solution, never off the solution space. So this is something intrinsically defined on the solution space. All these four, once I put these is wiggly equal, it's always something about the space of solutions. And this is the whole point, because conservation, what actually tells me, this is a very simple corollary, it's just what this means. If I integrate this quantity on M, this is just the, this has three terms, sigma in, sorry, let's put sigma out first, minus sigma in, and this because their two orientations are opposite, that's why there is a minus, plus a term on B, if there is any B. If I have a time-like boundary as well, there is a B here. So this being conserved tells me that this, that the sum of these three pieces is zero. So since we know that this has something to do with the degrees of freedom, the physical content of this equation is the degrees of freedom that are initially there either evolve out through sigma, or they leak through the time-like boundary. So this is a way to physical way to interpret this equation. And if sigma has no boundary, then omega sigma, which is the integral like this, is conserved. Is conserved on shell. So what does this mean? This means that if I look at the space of solutions, and we saw in the tutorial that the space of solutions to the equation of motion is precisely what one means by phase space in reality, then these, we expect to be able to relate these to the symplectic, to the actual symplectic form for the theory. But in fact, this is defined for now covariantly on the space of histories. Oops. So omega sigma, so F, we expect that the space of on-shell histories with a kipped with this symplectic structure, which doesn't matter on which sigma I computed. This is crucial because of the conservation. I can choose any sigma I like. So as in the tutorial, I could choose any cut I wanted of my space of my orbits. Here is the same thing. I can pick any sigma I like. Doesn't matter because it's conserved on shell. And this thing here should be morally phase space. Well, more than morally, this is actually that's the philosophy behind the covariant field space method, is to understand phase space in terms of these objects. The space of on-shell histories together with the covariant symplectic two form on that space. So pull back on that. So geometrically, I would say. And sorry, just again to reiterate, the delta phi that entered these objects satisfy the linearized equations of motion because they take me from one solution to another solution. So they must satisfy the linear. Yeah, so this is a good point to ask questions.
So could you repeat the analogy with the tutorial again? In the tutorial, we had all trajectories, and we saw that every trajectory, because we quotiented out the kernel, we saw that every trajectory is just one point. Can be one point. So we take any
cut. So in this space F bar, every solution to the equations of motion is seen as a point because it's the entire field configuration.
Right.
And so this is precisely that space. F is just the space.
Cases, right?
F bar is only the on-shell one. F is all of them. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So So now, means I'm just trying to draw analogy.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm.
So in this case, means every trajectory
is a
every trajectory in that case, after taking the section, every point would be like one on-shell condition with that whose property is that omega, right? Because along every f, that omega sigma is fixed.
So what this means, the conservation tells you that no matter which surface you choose to compute this object on, you get the same answer.
Okay. So in that case, means in the tutorial case,
mm-hmm.
could you write this bracket again? What would be that bracket in the tutorial case?
Yes, in the tutorial case, this would be the space of orbits, of trajectories. And this, we called it the reduced symplectic structure.
That F is after quotient.
So this is the PDQ without the T, without any. So this would be the PDQ in the tutorial.
Yeah.
And this is, and so the way I can think of this is either as this abstract space of on-shell histories or on a given sigma, the space of initial conditions on that surface. Of course, if there is gauge, things are subtle because gauge introduces gauge freedoms and ambiguity, so we will get there. But if there is no gauge, then the space of initial condition on sigma is parameterizes this space, and on that sigma, this is exactly what you would expect. And we will do this very explicitly later on. Now I just want to give the philosophy behind the.
If this is too much, we can skip it.
Yeah.
But is global hyperbolicity is the first place that popped in this corollary, or has it been important for earlier things as well?
I would say here.
Right here is where. It's
yeah. So this is telling you that global, and even then you could try to follow the different branches. It's just except that I don't think is really worth it. But in topological field theories, where anything that is of interest is topological change, you could still apply similar method. But it's just, but then the it's just not. Equations of motion for field theories on topologically changing manifold tend to have singularities where the topology change happens. So we don't want to worry about any of that. And,
But
you can do this. Well, no, sigma then would be maybe two copies of some, like a circle that becomes two circles has a singular point somewhere where you get an 8, but otherwise you would have.
We couldn't like restrict to one of those circles anymore, because then it would be.
Then it would be not conserved. Then you always need to keep track of all the boundaries components. OK, so this is that. And now I just want to start. Maybe let give me an example. But I think we start seeing where it goes. But let's the scalar field. So in this case, the scalar Lagrangian is what? Is 1/2. da phi plus m square phi square, for example, I could put the lambda cube part, but phi cube. So if I want to write it in terms of forms, then I would write it instead like this. Phi plus m I square epsilon. So what do I mean? This is the Hodge dual. This is, if you want, is the volume form, which is also the Hodge dual of one of the constant function. So if we want to only use the Hodge, that's. So I could also write it, in fact, as phi star phi, where I mean the Hodge dual of phi would also work.
And that's m squared.
That's it. So now, let me skip the equations of motion. It would be box of phi plus m squared phi. And let's look at theta. So theta, of course, doesn't depend if there are interaction, if there is a master, because it just cares about the pieces with derivatives. So this is, I look at it here. I need to take d of these and integrate by parts. So what I find is d phi well, they commute. I just put it in the other. D phi. So I write it in terms of the tensor, just to make it clearer. This is the derivative with the index up, essentially, because of the dualization, and in fact there is an extra e the nudge. So we see that when I compute omega, this is, well, here it starts looking like a bit of a symbol soup. Here is, in a sense, simpler. So this is just this. And when I pull it back on a surface, so sigma with normal and A, omega sigma, no matter which one, I choose, is integral H of, so the normal derivative is what enters here. Right? So this is d of dn phi wedge d phi. This is like the velocity. This is the time derivative of my scalar field. And we know that in this case, there is no gauge symmetry, no complications. This is essentially the momentum. So if I treat this guy independently from phi, and there are good reasons to do that, because the normal derivatives, there's no information about them intrinsically to the surface. So from the surface perspective, this is a completely new quantity as a block. So I just call it p, and I find my my phase space. So, but you see here, I didn't have to go on shell beforehand because the theory is simple. So, but in principle, so for n, because for any phi and any choice of velocity, there is a solution. So I'm done. I don't have to complicate my life. I can go on shell at this level and realize, oh, but for any phi and every velocity, there is one solution. So this is exactly what I want. The point is that working off shell is, of course, way, way easier. So in practice, going on shell is complicated. The more complicated the theory, the more complicated is to go on shell. So we will try at any time to find equalities that hold off shell. And if we cannot do any better, we will force them on shell. So the philosophy for what comes next is
omega, for instance, finding the equation of motion with omega?
No, the equations of, this has lost any track of what were the equations of motion. So the equations of motion are in E.
But it's kind of Poisson bracket, right, for our field.
But that doesn't,
I contracted with Hamiltonian, for instance.
We will get there. The point is, I hoped that. So there is a comment about this in the tutorial solutions, where I try to emphasize the fact that the dynamics is well understood in the tutorial was the constraint surface. But when you project down, it's gone. It's abstract in the sense that every point is a solution, but you don't really know exactly what that looks like anymore. So what is left over on the PDQ, the reduced phase space, is actually time translation symmetries, which is not quite the dynamic. So if the dynamic is, if the Hamiltonian is time independent, then time translation symmetry relates two neighboring solutions, which one is with the same initial condition, but at two slightly different times. And this looks like dynamics indeed. And I tried to draw figures in the lecture notes that explain this. But in fact, it's not quite the same, because if your dynamics is not time independent, like your Hamiltonian is not time independent, you don't have that symmetry. And so on the reduced phase space, you cannot really express a flow naturally in geometrical terms for these. So here is similar. There will be an Hamiltonian associated to time translation symmetries, but then I have to look at symmetries. And this is what I want to do next, of course. And I don't have time to start, but let me tell you what the logic of what I'm trying to do, what we're doing next is. So the next thing we're looking at is Noether theorems. And the idea there is to make concrete this triangle. We know that symmetries are related to conserved charges. Let's call them charges. And this is Noether 1, essentially. This tells me that every time I have a symmetry, I can define a current. The current is conserved. And so in a similar way, I can define charges on the sigmas, which, and this will be actually wanted to do today. It takes 2 minutes to do with the formalism we have. Super easy. The next step would be to connect these to the symplectic geometry. So this knows nothing about the symplectic geometry. So here we want Hamiltonian flows, or vector field, or just. And I want to close this triangle. This triangle is not so easy to close, depending on what one means there. And it doesn't always close either. So one has to be a little careful, because here I can ask questions on shell or off shell, and there will be differences. I can ask that things hold for omega as such, this covariant object, or for the actual phase space, which is slightly different. And so in usual cases like Young-Mills, Maxwell, or maybe if I'm looking at global symmetries for scalar fields, it doesn't really matter what you do off shell. Covariantly has direct analogs on shell. Guess what? It's not the case for gravity and diffeomorphism. So we will lay out the general theory and then identify precisely what goes wrong in gravity and in which sense diffeomorphisms are not the same as the gauge transformation as Maxwell. And this will be somewhat, there will be many things which are similar to the tutorial, but slightly different. But somehow the same themes will pop out again and again.